of it.
I've done. You know, it puts you on a douche list.
We are going to analyze, dissect,
scrutinize,
and celebrate the music we love. We are not journalists. We are not critics.
Driving
we are just three rock fans talking about the music
we love.
Anyone
that listens to this K-pop.
Love to hate.
Well, maybe it's two of us that like something and the third doesn't, or one of us hates something.
Pat slapped me upside the head just for liking the Stones.
You cutting rock and roll like a pig and just seeing it for its insides. You know what I mean?
I have my own version of that.
Our subject is in the midst of an age where rock and roll has pretty much disappeared.
And it was the old Giant Stadium, too. From the opening notes of Shine On You Crazy Diamond, I thought that place was going to lift off the ground and fly around.
I don't know if Michael Jackson was a fraction.
Oh, speaking of an overused logo,
Clueless when it came to rock and roll. With the whole hippie culture, the whole counterculture generation, missed the whole thing. All they wanted to do was have me. I'm glad they did.
We're thinking of festivals!
No, but that's cool.
That doesn't count. No!
It absolutely counts.
Why?
So that was good. You know, Woodstock might not have been as fun as it sounds. You gotta take a shit. There's nowhere to go. Yeah. Oh my God.
You're in a mud bath now.
Of course I would have loved to have seen the Beatles, but even it's not going to be one of my three concerts.
I wanted to see the Beatles when they were smoking pot, dropping acid. I want to see that Beatles live. Dude. What's wrong with this fucking world that Keith Richards is walking around and Axl Rose is performing in the wheelchair? What's wrong with this
Prince
fucking
dead.
World?
Yeah, well, that'll be the next.
Yeah, Prince
next
and Bowie
discussion.
Are dead.
Rock and roll as an informative medium, as a source of information.
That was our world. And when we were kids, we aspired to that, man.
We got lucky in that we had some of the greatest bands of the world ever.
But these were our fucking heroes, man. Now kids see the Stones on TV. It's just like, who are these old guys?
I mean, my job, I'm forced to work until I'm like 65. And then this retirement package.
That's what Keith Richards said, man. Keith Richards said about 5 or 6 years ago, he's like, oh, isn't the retirement age like 65? Now he's into his 70s.
Kind of fucking past that, didn't he? And Keith Richards is still walking the planet Earth. Sucking up all their fucking souls. That's what he's doing.
That's a good thing.
Thank God.
It's not just the Stones, this topic.
This branches out into aging rock stars in general.
Throw this right out there.
Like Gene and Paul. Like Paul's face looks like a big smeared like pancake with too much batter.
This is the culture of American Idol. They're not looking to cultivate any like evolution of an artist that has longevity. Yeah. That has staying power. Everything is what can we sell this
now.
Every time somebody dies, right, you go on Facebook, oh, rest in peace.
We're
going to do it out of Glenn Fry's dead. That's the end of the Eagles.
In a world
where there's no Rolling Stones.
Don't matter.
And there's no Beatles either. We're losing our fucking rock stars. So fuck you.
It's rock and roll, you see? And we're going to listen to it, and we're going to execute it, and then we're going to do it. And that's how it's going to be,
you
see?
Another beer?
Oh, yeah, I'm going to have another beer.
I've always thought that aging affects singers a little worse than guitar players. Yeah. I mean, Rob Halford's
case in point.
You know, all right, man. So Rob Halford, Paul Stanley.
Robert Plant.
And Plant. You know, Plant, no, you can still jam with Alison Krauss and shit, but no more Zeppelin.
Yeah, that's his roots stuff, that folky.
Yeah,
that's
what he does well now. Sure. He does that well, man. Stick with that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
We're not apologizing for it. It's time to quit, man. Show's called Rock Under Fire. You're under fire, motherfuckers. Fucking blast them. I got a few people that have not been very supportive about what we're doing, man. But anyways, one longtime friend of mine said the show pisses him off, right? He didn't say,
This is news to me.
Didn't say it's not my cup of tea.
Wow.
Said it's
pissing him off.
Right? So we're hitting some deep-seated buttons, man, apparently, right? A lot of self-righteous anger, right? Now, mind you, I got nothing but love and respect for this dude. He was actually...
This is somebody we know, like, that's tight with us?
Very much so. Very much so. Right? He was hugely influential on me. As a matter of fact, two of the bands I'm going to talk about tonight as being underrated, he gets the credit for getting me into absolutely.
Okay, I'm thinking of somebody, but it can't be him. No. All right. So that narrows it down to like two other people.
There's two dudes. They have the same
first name as you.
Okay, all right. Okay. We're good.
No hope. You knew. There's no chance these dudes would ever like what we're doing here. No, there's no chance in hell. Right. Love the guy.
We might not necessarily like what he's doing, but we still respect it.
No, love the guy.
Okay, so what's...
But, you know, hugely influenced... You know, I'm going to talk about bands he got me into tonight. He really influenced me at one time. Most recently, he got me into the punk band Killing Joke, which I actually really like. Mm-hmm. Right? So he knows his shit. He's very savvy, very smart. You know, I met the guy and just sucked off him like a sponge. That's what I do. You know, if you know your shit about music, I'll meet you and just suck all the musical knowledge out of you. Like a sponge and just leave the empty husk. Right? That's what I do. Apparently, you know, Mike, you know, but Pat, maybe you don't. Some of our listeners don't. There are people out there that have the idea, the opinion that acts from the past like Bruce Springsteen, Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin are just tired and old and passe and played out. Right, and I can see that. Right, they have the opinion. I think, you know, Pat. People think that ours is like the Rolling Stone magazine view of rock and roll history. Right, the things that we've
been
told.
That's the sense that I get that there are some people saying, you know, this is not hip enough, or it's not, you know, underground enough, or it's not.
Right.
Artsy fartsy enough.
Ours is the standard mainstream enough. Version of rock and roll history, and that there is another story to be told. And I'm sensitive to that, and there's truth in that. But, like you say, dude, beware of falling into that hipper than thou elitist trap, you know, because Bruce Springsteen isn't cool, man. You know, Bob Dylan is your grandparents' rock star, man. Why aren't you talking about LCD sound system? Or Animal Collective, man. And that's happening here, brother. It's happening here. There's a little bit of that going on.
We're trying. Look, when I put this thing together, man, my thing was to cover the broad spectrum of the history of rock and roll. And it's a broad-ass spectrum because it covers 7 fucking decades. Mm-hmm. All right? And I'm not going to limit myself to some philosophy that rock and roll began in 1977 and that is just as relevant in the 2000s as it was in the 1960s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And I'm just not, because until somebody could come up with one fucking band in the last 25 years that could be spoken of in the same sentence as the Beatles and the Stones and the Who and Pink Floyd and even R.E.M.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you should say that.
And even Nirvana, for that matter. Bring it to my attention. Bring it to my attention, man. We'll talk about it.
The first time I put the needle down on a Pink Floyd record, that vibe that I got, maybe people out there didn't get that same vibe, but they got that vibe from another record.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and some of those bands are around because of the bands that we've discussed. We're not totally disregarding those groups or acts or saying that they never existed. It's just that we really haven't. I mean, we're only 7 episodes into this thing. Who knows if we would have covered that or when we'll cover it? If, you know, I mean, like, you know,
I'm trying to get
like
an audience.
Like said,
man.
We're trying. Yeah, we are trying.
I'm
to
not
build
trying
an audience,
to appeal to one demographic or one genre of music.
But man, he said, "You're looking at 7 decades of material. Yeah. You know, we got a long way. We're in this for the long haul."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, brother.
You want to run around being a jackrabbit and be done with it? Okay, but you know, we're gonna be a couple tortoises around here. A few tortoises around here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we're just old tortoises. We're just 3 white guys talking about the music that we love. You know, we're not the hippest guys in the world. I'm half bald.
I mean, I have no problem. I'm all for talking about stuff that is unknown, that is should that deserves more attention.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, a lot of people like bands coming up, man, that people should know about. Yeah, man, I'm all for it. But I'm not going to make an entire show dedicated to bands that less than 10 people know about.
And just
shun everything else because it's too popular or too many people know about it.
Yeah, I don't get the shunning. It's because it's too popular.
The second 20 people know about it, they're suddenly on hip.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah, I don't get their tendency to reject the past too easily, right? So, yeah, you know what? If you have a band that has he was pissed off about the Doors album, right? If I said the Doors debut album was fucking great. Hold on. This fucking guy, man, I told him don't call me.
Is that your phone?
Man. Yeah, I don't know why this guy's ringing? Calling me. Now.
Screw that, man.
Hello. What? When? Where? You gotta be fucking kidding me. Fuck me, man. That's huge news. Guys, the world's greatest band has just been formed. They're called Stop and Frisk. They're from Berkeley, California. And they just formed this morning. Gotta be fucking... They're better than the Beatles and the Stones. What? Holy crap, on a croissant. The only people that know about them are the singer's girlfriend and the drummer's mom. Fucking A, bro. Thanks. Thanks for telling me.
Wow.
There you have it, guys. The world's coolest band is actually called Stop and Frisk. They're better than the Beatles and the Stones, and only fucking two people know about them. Who guessed? You know, they got it. You know what?
They might not be hip after this show.
If only the drummer's girlfriend and singer's mom knows about them. They gotta be the fucking best. They gotta be great.
It's like with the internet, you'd hope that criticism would just die out too.
Yes, we have a good brother. Ew. Michael Lee Nierenberg.
How hard is that? How hard is that? Have you had any coffee?
No, man. My first real thought was like, it's going to be like, you know,
it's business.
You know, it's like taking right. a shit. Is it like being constipated and taking a shit, and after like the whole movie is just done,
yeah,
and
but
you just exhale and you're like, I'm done with this at some point?
The difference is after you take a shit, you kind of feel better.
So the outlaw stuff I can stand, but because they led to like the Allman Brothers, Lynyrd Skynyrds of the world and stuff like
and
that.
And that's the stuff I don't like. I love hip hop and I love heavy metal and it sounds terrible together.
That's where I was going before.
What are your favorite punk bands?
You know what? That's actually one of the easier questions because they're always the first few.
Yeah, now that we got this podcast going, I'm boning up on all my shit.
Best metal record of all time.
Screaming for Vengeance.
I knew you were going to say that.
Black Sabbath.
I knew you were going to say that.
To be done. I thought Public Enemy and Anthrax was actually pretty good compared to everything that came after that. Yeah. Like everything.
How does he do that? It's got to be an exaggeration.
No,
maybe he's listening to something new every day. But not
this morning I was listening.
You're looking for things.
Yeah, like, what are you talking about? I was like, I'm the show's biggest supporter.
You're right. It changed a lot. That changed a lot for me. I started experimenting in stuff that I would never have listened to. Like, whoa, not
fuck
getting votes anymore.
Fuck everyone. I'd like to see him lose his shit. Just alter the narrative
alter
a little
the narrative
bit.
Alter a little
the narrative
bit.
A little bit.
I'm a very, very amateur photographer. So when I took a glance at your book, I was, like I said in the beginning, I was just blown away by it. But my question, because you kind of almost touched on it a little bit. When Chris came to you and said, this is what we're looking to do, and they were going to paint their faces, and they were going to kind of shock the world. What was your initial reaction to that?
Well, it wasn't initially for a white face. It was initially like a feminine makeup, sort of like the New York Dolls.
Right.
And there's a picture that's famous, pretty famous. It's not in my book because I didn't take it, and I had no way of reaching the photographer to ask for permission or to pay for it, so I didn't put it in my book. But it's a pretty famous one of them in the hallway where Ace kind of looks like Lily Tomlin.
Yeah,
I know that shot.
The twiggy eyes, and Jean looks like a transvestite. And yeah,
we all know that one.
Yeah, we do.
That was the original look, and then it kind of wasn't working because Gene and Paul are bigger guys.
Sure.
You know, Peter and Ace were littler, and so they decided to go the white face route. And you know, they were just experimenting at the time, and it was like it all happened little. You know, like it didn't happen like so quickly as everybody thinks, but you know, maybe in my mind it was a little, you know, slowly. But I'm just saying to myself, how do I explain this to my job and my parents? Treated me the same anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, as much as we love Peter, I tend to believe your side of this. And
Peter likes to exaggerate.
Well, yeah, we know this. This has been established over the years for, you know. But
yeah.
Speaking of Deborah, just on a personal note, as somebody who most of my best friends are over the years have been women, so I've been, you know, I have a very good innate understanding of just as somebody has just like, you know, talked and seen so many girls through the horrible shit of a breakup. What I've learned most from your split with Peter is that every woman needs a cousin like Phyllis. I'm serious about
that's not,
that. I'm serious about
Phyllis
that.
Phyllis isn't
and
in the
for anybody wondering about that, read get the
I'm wondering
book
about
and
that.
Read the damn book.
Who's Phyllis?
I'm telling you.
Phyllis is a character.
Going back to Chuck's comments on Sousa being, you know, synonymous with marching music, mm-hmm. or Bob Marley being synonymous with reggae, because a lot of Americans, a lot of rock and rollers, man, Bob Marley's the token reggae artist.
Yeah.
So much so that he often gets associated with rock and roll. He's a rock star, mm-hmm. to a lot of Americans, at least.
Yeah.
They play him on rock and roll stations.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's just like, how do we, you know, I don't want to say how do we justify that, how do we validate it, but how do we reconcile the fact that, yeah, he's reggae. Do we put Toots and the Maytals in the same sentence as the Rolling Stones?
We could have an episode based on that. That's a big can of worms, you know?
Yeah.
And I have a very broad definition of rock and roll. That's why, to the chagrin of Tracy and others, I include Bjork in rock and roll, you know?
Bjork.
It's a big umbrella to me in terms of sound and style.
No, and I agree.
In his article, he mentioned ABBA. That's the one fucking thing.
ABBA's disco, but yeah, you know what? I would welcome ABBA in a rock and roll.
Bjork, I don't know what. Oh, yeah. I don't know what Bjork is.
Well, they are in a rock hall of fame, aren't they?
Is ABBA in a rock hall?
I think they are.
Probably, but you know what?
I'm pretty sure they are.
The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I give no fucking credit to. There's no.
I mean, to me, the ABBA is the Beatles of the 70s, man. I think they're by far the most influential band of the 70s, man. But that
ABBA?
Might be a different,
you know,
yeah.
Rock and roll. There's no.
No, I never said rock and roll. I just said I think they're the most influential band of the 70s.
The 70s?
Group.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I would say the Bee Gees.
I think ABBA's reach extended farther than the Bee Gees, man. I think the Bee Gees are more to their time. That's a good conversation. When we do the disco episode, man.
That band was fucking. Yeah, those fucking guys couldn't go anywhere. The fucking Bee Gees.
No, man.
I just think ABBA's reach, their influence extended far into the 90s, man, and like Euro pop and all that stuff that happened as directly goes back to ABBA, man. I just, I don't know.
I don't care about Bjork. She comes out looking like a fucking swan or whatever the hell she is at every award show. I don't care. Go do it. Go. Bye.
I don't know how we're looking on time, boys, but
it's time to wrap up.
We'll end the show on a didactic note, on a learning note. We're going to teach you something on the way out. In 300 years, will there be Homo sapiens to listen to the music? Homo means standing upright. All Latin words have a meaning. We're standing upright. Doesn't mean we're the gay ape. Homo, the gay ape. But no, homo means standing upright. Do you guys know what the word sapiens means? We're Homo sapiens, the Latin name.
Homer Simpsons.
Of us, our species, sapiens. Homo standing upright. Sapiens. If you look the word sapient up in the dictionary, it is smart and all-knowing. That's how arrogant we are, man. Homo sapiens, we are the thinking ape. The ones that are literally full of knowledge. If you look at the word sapient or sapiens, we're the full of knowledge ape. That's how fucking smart we think we are.
I'm still stuck back on Homo the gay ape, man. It's like a new character, it used to be like a cartoon.
Homo the gay ape.
Smartest species of animal, and we've sown the seeds for our own destruction. Good night.
There you go, Mike. Take these testicles across your nose.
I don't want to have to experience the wrath of Mick Jagger.
You've been teabagged by YouTube.
Oh, we're going to come over there, and we're going to throw our testicles on your nose. LOL.
Go.
How's my taint tasting, Sonny? LOL.
But really, I was just trying to help. I was, you know, consider it free advertising.
It doesn't matter. Money is money. What's it matter anyway? It's $100 bills every
morning. How can you have any pudding? I'm not even going to say the rest because I don't want to infringe on anybody's copyrights.
They approached me to be in that movie. I said, why not? I'm kind of teaching a cat every pudding.
Golden age is over. There's no giants like there, you know, I don't have to say their names.
And the only argument I hear from anybody is, well, there's plenty of good bands out there. I know there are, man. I know there are, but where are the great ones? Where's the music? Where's the masterpiece?
Where's the Rolling Stones and Pink Floyd, for instance?
Where's the masterpiece albums of the past 15 to 20 years, man? I don't care if you can name 20 new bands that came out.
What's the modern white album?
Not quantity. Where's the masterpieces? Stop fucking telling me about the black keys. How many different ways can you strum an A chord on top of a snare drum?
Dropping bombs.
Everybody loves them these days. That's
I mean, that went out
group.
Of style on the White Stripes second fucking album. Oh, we're going to play without a bass player. That's revolutionary. I wonder where that came from.
Don't let Jay hear you say that. He loves the Black Keys. I could take him or leave him.
You know, yeah, they rock. They rock. They rock. But who cares? What's the lead singer's name? Can anybody name their lead singer?
Mm-hmm.
Can anybody name their bass player? Well,
no,
not their bass player. They don't have a bass
no
player.
There's no charismatic stars. Except Lady Gaga.
It's color by numbers, man. It's like we're all of the original artists, man. All the artists that matter painted a picture. Ooh. They painted pictures. They painted masterpieces. You know what they're doing now? They're buying these
paint
little connected
numbers,
dots,
bitch.
Man, and they're filling it in.
Ooh, Mike's eating red meat tonight, Pat.
Yeah, he's out there for blood.
But you know what? We're in a period of stagnation.
People.
Now, here's the thing. It's like
stagnation
we're not
nation.
We're not saying that rock doesn't exist. I'm not saying that rock doesn't exist at all. I'm saying it's dead.
Rock is dead. Roger Daltrey was right.
It's dead. It's like Weekend at Bernie's. Rock is here on the fucking couch, but he's dead.
It's not even. Beep.
And people are in denial. Beep. Well, it's on life support. Beep. It's just going through a period of, yeah. Well, it's going through a period. No, it's been erased. As irrelevant as the Grammys have become, this is what it is. The Grammys have become the VMAs.
And the guitar is not the primal instrument in music.
Well,
anymore.
Did you hear Bon Iver?
Bon Iver.
Sensitive bearded males is not going to push rock and roll forward. It's just not.
No.
And he tried that in the 70s. It was called Boston.
That, you know, England is fucking
Janet,
swinging from the
Janet
chandelier.
Jackson.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
The Super Bowl.
We still have that.
Yeah.
That,
oh, my God, my poor kid's eyes are
yeah, the children. The children,
blood,
man.
The children. When the fuck did the children take over
we've
the
got
world?
That, we've got that Puritan lineage, man.
Fuck
that, you.
You
know, like we're,
go to your room with no fucking
everything
dinner.
Everything is all sex and violence on TV, but yeah. The second something happened spontaneously, man, everybody crawled out of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, man.
That fucking asshole mother complaining about Janet Jackson's tit has got fucking five different boyfriends hanging the line, ignoring mm-hmm. her fucking kid playing a fucking computer game that has more violence than she could even fucking imagine, because I play the same games. That's a fucking... Get fucking bent. Rant over.
But with Chuck, yeah. You know, with Chuck, the guitar became... getting into our topic, it just became, you know, think about Jimmy, man, burning his
weapon.
Guitar, the whole sacramental thing on
weapon.
Stage at Monterey, man. Guitars became, it was like a fucking machine gun. It was like an extension of your cock. Here's what I'm going to suggest. Prior to the guitar, or at the same time as the guitar, because Chuck, you know, the founding fathers, there was a time when you had like Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis banging away on the piano, just as badass. The piano was like a central instrument in rock and roll. And then at some point in the late 60s into the 70s, you had, you know, Liberace was still cool. You know, he was like the big, you know, he was the big showman, you know.
Liberace's totally
Liberace,
cool.
Man.
Hey.
Don't be hating on Liberace.
And then, you know, you had Barry Manilow. You had this, the beginning of the singer-songwriter thing. So aside from the folky guitarist, you had the whole Carole King thing and Burt Bacharach.
Yeah,
you know? And the most rocking thing you got from the piano in the 70s was Billy Joel and Elton John.
Yeah, no,
okay,
no, no.
And Billy Joel once said, trying to put his finger on why the critics never really took him seriously as like hip and cool, and you know, being spoken of in the same sentence as like say Lou Reed, or
Bowie or Bruce or Bob,
even Mark Bolan. You know, he said, well, maybe if I had a guitar instead of a piano, you know, the piano became uncool in the 70s. In rock and roll,
it like you said, the singer songwriter. It was associated with the singer songwriter thing.
Yeah,
because the guitar kind of.
I think there's something to that.
I think the guitar in the 21st century has become to the 21st century what the piano became to the 70s. A lot of acoustic guitars now. The guitar has basically become this secondary instrument to accompany wimpy songs. I think.
Yeah,
that's where you get.
So what's taking
a background supporting role?
What's the instrument now?
I don't think we focus on any one instrument. Now, this is taken out. This is excluding, like, the people that take guitar seriously. Like, you know, like the ones who still listen to Aldi Meola and that Joe Bonamassa, whatever his name is.
Joe Bonamassa.
These guys. Yeah, I mean,
Zach Wilde.
If you play, like, guitar for guitar's sake, man, and you're that stuff
they're out there.
Is what
and
it
guitar
is.
Guitar is still,
that's still
it's
huge.
Still a staple, sure.
That's still huge.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And everybody in this room has gone to see
a
show.
I'm talking strictly mainstream. Pop music, mainstream music, where, again... rock and roll once inhabited. Okay, it was it marked its territory.
That
man.
Thing right over to your right over there, that's what took the guitar's place. A computer.
Yeah, maybe, man.
A computer.
That yeah, you know what? That's the instrument.
Everything can
over
be
there.
Fucking loaded into that thing.
That
I can
see
that
HP. You know, that's
I'm gonna,
the problem.
I'm gonna say something.
That's the instrument that took over for the guitar.
All right.
Dear Hewlett-Packard.
All right, I was talking
Stick
to
Nixon thinks.
I was talking to Tracy the other day, and we were talking about 90210. Remember that show?
Yeah.
All right. I was
How
a closet.
Do I talk to an angel?
I was a closet 90210 fan.
So was I.
90210, whatever.
I watched
210,
it with her.
210 or 120?
90210.
Okay. I was a closet fan in the 90s. All right.
No,
I had a girlfriend who I never saw on a Wednesday, man. We just I always made sure that we didn't get together on a Wednesday. And if we did, my VHS was taping 90210. All right. Do you remember at the very the last couple seasons there was a guy named Ray, there was
the
a character
player.
Named Ray, the guitarist.
He went on to sing that song, How Do You Talk to an Angel?
All right. Who played do you remember who played him? I don't know.
I don't remember who played him, but he was a musician. He really was a musician.
Was
That's
there
the
but remember the character, man? He was just like this guy
jerk
like,
off.
You know, you would never know like him from like a guy in a gym or a guy that works at the Apple store or like, you know, there was nothing rock about him. There was nothing musician. He had the
a
perfect
grungy,
haircut
and he had a
you
flannel
know,
shirt
and the flannel shirt, you know,
he threw Tori Spelling down the stairs or something like that, right?
But there was just like, yeah, they had that one episode where, we have to have some bad in this guy. Yeah. We have to, ooh, look at him. He's going through his like horrible phase, and then he's going to end up on VH1, whatever happened to. And later, things turned to shit for Ray. And you made a point about Ed Sheeran sounding like he came off The Voice or the American Idol or something.
Yeah.
Like, there is nothing sounds rock like and roll about any of these people.
We're back to being
far
dirtbags again, gentlemen. That's what we're back to.
That's what
right.
I was just thinking. As a positive side to it.
Yeah.
You know?
We could be back to being sheltered and fucking looked upon as scum. I'm cool with that.
And it's cool again.
Fuck off.
That makes it cool again.
Take your political correct ass across the fucking street. Stay out of my deli.
Long hair is cool again. You want to conjure up Satan, man. Let's have a seance.
Didn't I say that? Didn't I say that once? That we need a good Satanist?
Cool
Ouija
board,
we need a good fucking Satanist to come up with some backwards messaging, or I said something about a drug addict, too, I think. But we need some good backwards messaging put back in
the drugs
music.
Back to
the
music.
I'm going to fuck you up. What the fuck did he just say?
That's the problem.
We need more of that.
Not
what
enough
did he say?
These artists
need more
doing drugs.
What the fuck did he just say? Spin that record backwards. Put Rob Halford on trial again. Bring that back.
Ozzy for fucking Suicide Solution and D. Snyder in front of the PMRC with fucking Frank Zappa.
Somebody blow their face. All the guns, man. Somebody take one and blow their face off for Christ's sake and blame Judas Priest again. We need this. We need the publicity in rock and roll.
There's
folks.
An image of Tina Turner, and you'll hear, you know, you can go to his website and check out his imagery. Sid Vicious images too, but there's an image in particular of Tina Turner that he took that was, and he explains it, there was a little bit of luck involved in it and everything, but it's brilliant. It really gets what Tina Turner was all about, man. Yeah. You know, Ike and Tina days I'm going back to. I'm not talking about the What's Love Got to Do With It era. I'm talking about Ike and Tina. The shit is just on point.
I'd like to welcome you, Bob Gruen, to the Rock Under Fire podcast. Let me throw some quotes at you at the outset. I want to throw some quotes at you and you give me your thoughts. These are associated with you. No is not an answer.
Don't believe everything you read on the internet.
Well, you know what? I know, I'm quoting you, man. I'm quoting you, quoting somebody
else.
Are
you quoting me or the internet?
I'm quoting you, quoting somebody else. And you'll know exactly who, you know, where this is
all
coming from.
Because
this was profound, man. And this has stuck with me for a long time, man. It's two quotes, okay? No is not an answer to accept, but it can be the beginning of an interesting conversation.
My mother said that.
Your mother said that. Just your experience with that.
Well, my parents were attorneys, and, you know, they learned how to have discussions and persuasive discussions. And so the other one, I don't know, was this, the other one you were going to get was, it's easier to ask for permission than, it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission.
Oh, man, and you knew that, man. You knew exactly where I was going.
Yeah, because that one was from my dad. And the point being that, you know, a lot of times if you try to explain something or ask for something that makes total sense, people won't understand it and they'll say no. But often when people say no, they don't quite understand why the answer should be yes. So you merely have to explain it to them. And sometimes that takes a while, or sometimes it's relatively easy. It usually takes a while.
And the other one, obviously a big cultural phrase related to the counterculture, turn on, tune in, drop out. Timothy Leary.
Right.
kind of associated with the LSD layer of the countercultural 60s, or, you know, more specifically the electric Kool-Aid thing. Kind of a phrase of its time, but it worked out pretty well for you, man. It worked out pretty well for you.
Yes, it did. You know, I wasn't expecting it to, because, you know, at the time, the idea of working for the establishment that was fighting what we felt was an illegal war was not really a positive career choice for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Also, people wanted more spontaneity and freedom in their life and didn't want to just, you know, decide at 18 what job they were going to put on a suit and tie for and do for the rest of their life. You know, I kind of like that idea of turn on, tune in, and drop out and live in what we called an alternate society. And that's why I was living with a rock and roll band. As it turned out, when they got a deal with a record company, because I had been taking pictures, and not as a job, but as my friends, because photography was my hobby, I just always took pictures of my friends. But when they got a record deal, the record company liked my pictures and used my pictures and started to ask me to take more of other groups.
That's awesome.
And this didn't seem so much like a job. It seemed like what I had already been doing, you know, taking pictures of musicians and basically having a good time. So that's what I've been doing ever since. So, wow. Yeah, I dropped out, but I actually fell in.
I want you to imagine this. Imagine a tropical paradise of a festival. A place where lots of Insta models exist and roam around freely. Where you could do a Victoria's Secret or a Vogue photo shoot. A scenario where you could be lured by the biggest bullshit marketing scheme in the history of music. The type of thing where you could buy your way onto a private island and enjoy a whole bunch of jet skiing and 48 hours of live music and fine dining and art and yoga and yachts. And there's all different types of packages you can get, too. If you're one of those unkempt poor motherfuckers who can only afford the $1,500 package, it still pays for your airfare, your ticket to the festival, your meals, and hospitality. And hospitality's important when you're shelling out the big bucks. And if you're not one of those poor assholes, you can get the better packages of quote-unquote elevated amenities. You got your retreat package, the nest package, we have your lodge package, all for the very low price of $9,000. And if that doesn't appeal to you, you can always upgrade to the VIP package, where they might even let you fuck one of the models. Never mind the fact that we have no plumbing, or that we're not equipped to deal with a rainstorm like those primitive savages did at Yazger's farm in 1969. Never mind that we have no infrastructure put in place. We were ill-equipped. We weren't prepared. We were overwhelmed. We didn't have the capacity to create an event of this scale. But you did. You created it. You got your models to advertise the hell out of it because we saw it for months. And you took the money. But you took the money and you didn't spend the money on preparing for the festival. No, 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 no. You spent the money on the models to market this thing to the filthy rich. And that is an extreme low for the concert industry and for music. Even lower, I dare say, than the corporate takeover of media, because it's symbolic. It's symbolic of the arrogant excess of a very small percentage who like to beat their chest over their ability to fuck people over. It's symbolic of the rewards of the winning in society, the greed. And the greed is now touched ruthlessly upon music. The people who get to own their own island and throw a party and get so carried away that they actually forget to plan for it.
Oh, I'm getting a phone call from Chesterfield, Massachusetts right now.
Hello?
Is that one of our
I should answer live on air, right?
Put him on speaker.
Yeah. Hi, you're on the Rock Under Fire podcast. Hi, you're on the Rock Under Fire podcast.
Hello?
So you're going to end up editing it out.
They hung up.
Maybe that's the way to get rid of telemarketers.
That's exactly what I'm going to fucking do. Hi, you're on air. What can we do for you? Who the fuck's calling me from Massachusetts at 8:30 on a Thursday?
Do you know what
Shirley
Temple Sleeve say?
What's up?
Welcome to the Rolling Stones. They're good guys.
Is that what it says?
Yeah, I Googled it. I actually Googled it years ago.
It says, welcome to the Rolling Stones. They're good guys?
They're good guys. I could never tell what it said on her sleeves. Yeah. I could see it said, welcome to the Rolling Stones. But then it says on the sleeves, they're good guys. Just make music for music's sake. Make your people happy.
I don't know. The way I see it is, and this is not, you know, I'll stand up for, I'll even defend Ted Nugent on this one. But the way I see it is, I read comments where people say, well, you know, you should stick to your day job. I've been a fan of yours for 30 years, but you should never have supported said politician. I'm never going to listen to you again. And
nonsense.
How dare you support, spit your opinion in my, you know, stick to your day job, that kind of thing. Yeah, there's a lot of rock stars and Hollywood people that voice their opinions. I think it's crucial that, you know, we say what we have to say, that with just the fact that we're allowed to say it, you know, they're citizens, they vote, they have one vote like each of us. A lot of them are rich, a lot richer than we are.
Which makes their voice heard more, because they're saying the same things
well,
we're saying.
You know, it's a, well, I mean, some of the comments I read that, well, some of these people shouldn't voice their opinions and they should stick to their day job. I mean, each of these people have day jobs, and I have to read their comments every single day. Like, they're putting their opinions on
okay.
Facebook. So they're like, what is Facebook if not like little microcosms of the big picture? So if somebody's saying it to 300 people and the celebrity's saying it to 3 million people, they still have a day job. This is their profession that they get paid for.
And at the root of it, the message is still the same.
And
whatever side, you know, of the, whatever
I'll go,
side of the
I go to the
on.
Dentist. I'll go to the dentist, and the first thing that happens, I sit in the dentist chair, and I'm paying for a fucking filling or something. And the first thing my dentist does is stick a monitor with Fox News in front of my face.
My dentist actually has CNN.
And then I got to sit there, and the dentist is talking to his assistant, and he's bitching about what a disgrace the president is, and I'm sitting there with fucking drool coming out of my mouth, helpless. I go to the deli for a sandwich, and there's a big TV with Fox News going on, you know, and I just want to buy a sandwich. I go to the friggin' car dealer for an oil change, and I'm sitting there, and Fox News is in front. You know what I mean? So it's like little professions all over, whether you make $50,000 a year, $10,000 a year, or $500,000 a year, people are spitting their opinions in your face, even when you don't realize it. And a lot of people don't realize it because a lot of people agree with it, so they just kind of click like and move on.
Silent has muted your video, blah, blah, blah. Contains copyrighted material. Claim by Pink Floyd. 2 minutes later, I get one from Jerry Rafferty, who's dead. Baker Street.
From the grave.
I spent an hour talking about Baker Street, and here comes Jerry Rafferty from the grave bitching that I'm using his song.
You know what we should do? I got to interrupt you again. We should play only our vocal track to that podcast for the people, and then have them just imagine the music of what we actually played. Just imagine, if you will, what we were playing, and then just quickly go back into each one, in the in and the out, and the whole. That might be a something to look at in the future.
Exhale, you know, like that Whitney Houston song, "Waiting to Exhale," or the movie, or whatever. Like, I finally realized what that meant.
I just gave you a Props look
to
like
Whitney, man.
How do you know that?
Fuck you.
Mike likes Whitney. Houston style.
Anyway.
Bad reference. Oh God.
Anyway. You're snorting in the microphone.
We're full of bad references here. I don't know, it's just always been in my head that the band is making more money free and clear by doing that.
I don't know. How much money can you make on a T-shirt? You know, you don't make money on a T-shirt.
So
it's I think it's just more of the logo infringement. You know, that these scalpers are, you know, reproducing cheap T-shirts and
I mean, let's say $2,500 a night. Yeah, 10 cities.
So another one would be album sales. Well, it used to be album sales. Yeah. Now it's like streaming because you don't really sell hard copies anymore.
And they're not even making that much money on that, the artist.
And the biggest is probably licensing. Today it's crazy because it's as far as anything that's really lucrative and viable in terms of it's probably the way to go for a lot of people that can't get out there and tour on the same level that they once did or tour at all, like Zeppelin. So giving Rock and Roll or Black Dog or whatever song they gave to Cadillac is a nice payday where they can't go out and, like, you know, The Who. When was the last time The Who sold a single album? You know, they made more money off of CSI or NCIS or CIS or CSIC
or CSI Miami or
whatever it was. But you know what I'm talking about? There's that show with the
Eminem's front is like been in commercials the last 6 months or a year as well.
Right, and, and music has become the new product placement in movies, in TV shows, you know.
Commercials, yeah.
Because it's our generation who is now the major consumers. And when you see these commercials now and you hear The Who and you hear Zeppelin, it's us and, you know, people a little bit older than us. We're the major consumers and we hear the songs like, yeah.
I'm going to go buy a Cadillac.
Zeppelin. Yeah. You know, the United States is the most influential on music culture, but the most far behind the eight ball in tracking their licensing and rights to their music. Right. And this is where all this stuff is kind of sliding under the radar. And
our broadcast. They caught us.
Is obviously, yeah, exactly. This is obviously a very small operation, very niche group that is playing by the rules.
Yeah.
And so that's interesting to hear. But that's why, you know, when you're looking at a larger, a blanket purchase, a blanket license model, it makes more sense where you're saying, okay, you can use this for, you know, live performance on terrestrial radio, for playing on terrestrial radio, for playing on digital radio, anything over satellite, anything in a movie. You're paying more upfront, but it's a flat rate that's negotiated, and it ties up all those entanglements about the different areas where you're producing, you know, where you're putting a piece of music.
Right. Okay. Being the local idiot on this show sometimes, so correct me if I'm wrong. Let's say Q104 is playing Stairway to Heaven. It costs 3 cents per play. How much goes where? I mean, ASCAP has to get their portion of it, and then the artist gets their portion of it. Does that sound, am I accurate?
Yeah, I think you're accurate. A terrestrial radio is not the place to reference anymore because they pay the least amount of money.
So it's satellite radio.
It's
now,
correct. Okay. Yeah, because
BMI was started because it was an actual reaction against ASCAP, because it was like sometime in the 40s, ASCAP started charging radio stations to play their music.
Today,
kind of like, you know, hey, they should be lucky that we're playing, that we're getting this stuff. Consider it free advertising for your music, for your artists. Okay, and they started, and a radio station, there was kind of like a backlash. They said, fuck you. And BMI was started as a backlash against that. And, you know, ASCAP had no black artists. There was no blues. There was no country. There was, it was just like, it was, you had your like Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra, later on Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
So as a result of BMI, that exposed the American population to this blues music and country western and stuff, like, you know, later on, that became the foundation of rock and roll. So it's kind of now they're both like just like two arms of the same monster.
And I would say, correct me if I'm wrong, but there would be no need for these organizations if they weren't making money from licensing.
Exactly. Like I said, cut out that middleman. Everybody, you know, that one, once you take away that piece of the pie, everybody's going to be a little happier.
Right.
I mean, the legends of Keith and Anita, the vampire stories where their heroin intake would go up to a point that became critical mass, and then they would pay to the locals, this is the south of France at the time, to give them their blood. Oh. They would lie on separate tables while the blood was going out of Keith. The blood from the paid person was going into Keith to lower his heroin addiction, you know. And then
truth
they would pay.
Or fiction.
That's a fucking great story.
And the other part of it is
the story is more important than the truth.
Anita and Keith would like perversely give the help heroin as a little bonus for their thing, just to watch them get hooked.
Woodstock in August, all right? So it's August, and we're in 1969, and then within a year, John is declaring the dream is over. And in between, you have Altamont. What went wrong besides Altamont? Because I can't see Altamont, because I've heard writers refer to Altamont, the apocalypse at Altamont, the death of the dream, the death of the 60s, the 60s ended at Altamont.
That was the Stones,
it
right?
Wasn't so Angels. Much
it, symbolically, man. I can see
really
that,
was,
but
really was.
It wasn't so much the event of that late December of 1969 that brought it home. It was the film, the Meles Brother film, of when you sat
watching
and
Yumi
you watched
Shelter.
It on the screen, and you saw the other side of the counterculture.
Yeah.
And the same year came Easy Rider.
Okay.
And when Peter Fonda just looks at Dennis Hopper before he's blown away and says, we've blown it, man. We've blown it.
Yeah.
We fucking blew it. We had it. And if you're a Dylanologist, you know, you could see when Dylan agonizes over this in the basement tapes. Nothing was delivered. I say this truth to you, not out of fear or anger, but simply because it's true. We fucking blew it. We had it. Or did we? Can utopia ever be achieved? But if it's the utopia of the mind and people who have found an awareness of, and that's the whole thing of the ecology movement and interconnectedness of everything in nature. And that's where it's gone now. When you have people who are aware now of the interconnectedness of the entire cosmos and the flow of life in the cosmos, it kind of begins there, but it never ended, man.
That's what I was wondering, like, just about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, like, what is Neil Young talking about, man? That he said, what is it that he feels has died?
The hippie dream. Neil's obsessed with it.
Yeah, and he never got over it. And the fact that there was really nothing to not get over, because if you think about it, like you said, it's still being felt today.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the hippies won, man.
Absolutely. I mean, young people all the time these young people had never, you know, heard any of the 60s music or anything, but they're there. They're really beautiful people. And the way their lifestyle, the way they eat, and, you know, eating is so important. I mean, most people eat shit, you know. And look at the 1950s. Look at any of the movies and what was going on. And there was nothing of that going on like that. That's what I'm saying. There was a quantum leap in consciousness that occurred at the time. And it's kind of the rock being thrown in the center of the pond. And the ripples keep going on and on. And the ripple number 75 has no idea the rock ever hit the pond.
Yeah.
Right. But it just got the vibe on it, you know. And
so we used to love it there.
That's because you're straddling two tables.
I am straddling. Woodbridge was ready for that back then. Yep. They were selling like
I can handle two, Mike. It's okay.
You know, they thought they were still in Woodstock back then. You know, back then, and I don't think it was too legal back then to be selling.
Yeah,
they shut them down.
Oh, they got shut down?
I think they got shut down after a while.
Wow. Selling mushrooms out of the magic mushroom.
Possibly. You never know.
Oh, right, Billy Joel. Billy Joel.
I saw him.
Okay. Let me tell you a little story about Billy Joel.
Please do.
I wanted to see him so bad, I never got to see him. Mm-hmm. So for like 4 years in a row, my husband like put his picture in a card every year, and I, you know, never got the ticket
ever. Put Billy Joel's picture in a card?
Yeah, like I was getting a ticket. You know, like, hey, Billy, say hello. Hey, this is your gift, but never get it.
A picture of Billy Joel.
Yeah, like we were going to the concert, but we never did. You know, like the gift that you never get. So he would print out Billy Joel's picture.
I want to have sex tonight, huh? Here's a picture. Yeah. Safe to say.
Well, we used to just cut through somebody's yard.
My brother lost all his teeth. It was
with the dog, and then we went to the park.
My brother lost all his teeth over there.
Really?
He was riding a dirt bike.
Oh,
and
shit.
Smashed on that cut through right there.
Yeah. Oh, I remember that. But anyway, I had my own phone. And I remember when I picked it up to talk, I could hear this guy talking kind of, and he could hear me. So he said, give me your number. I'm going to call you, and we'll figure out what's wrong with our phones. I'm like, okay. So I gave him my number. Here I'm like 7th grade maybe, 8th grade.
Oblivious.
And I just – and so he's talking to me, asking me what – my hair color was, my eye color, where I went to school. I told him everything.
Holy shit.
Well, he said he was like my age or whatever. He loved the Rolling Stones, too. I remember that. All that. So anyway, I'm like, okay. So then he said he was going to – then he started getting real creepy. Told me he's going to be – he knows where I go to school. He was, you know. So I told my mom. I think I told my mom about
it. Did he have some candy for you?
And I never did see him because she started driving me. Thank God I told her, though. I could have been kidnapped.
Oh my God!
I murdered. I know.
You were very bright back then.
Good times.
Well, you probably did that
good
too.
Good old fucking 70s.
I thought it was probably.
I would ever. No, I don't think I would.
If he sounded cute and a boy was on the phone and he say like the Rolling Stones.
I was playing with Barbie.
Stones.
Sort of, as I said, lavish, sophisticated arrangements. And look at Barry White. I mean, Barry White is a kind of epitome of disco. That guy. I don't think when he performed
the love theme.
You know. The love man. I mean, he never sweated, right? I mean, he was like the opposite of James Brown, right?
Yeah.
James Brown, the hardest working man in show business, and it's true. You can find any clip of James Brown.
I'll tell you, he was sweating Barry White because he was really trying to fit into the whole disco thing. You know, it was kind of like if you can't beat him, join him type of thing around 76. Wasn't that the case with James Brown?
Yes. I mean, James Brown had the most ambivalent relationship to disco. I mean, he hated it, but he wanted to be a part of it. You know, you can get diametrically opposed views of disco from James Brown, depending upon the source, depending upon the year. But he did resent it, and he resented the fact that here you have this, you know, this, I'm sure he thought, I mean, I shouldn't say that, but I know he resented Barry White. He calls him out in one of his songs. And I think partly he must have hated Barry White for his, well, the fact that he didn't have to work the way that James Brown did, you know? And, you know, I suspect that James Brown's, I mean, the kind of music that I think James Brown really, really liked really wasn't disco, you know? But Barry White was one of the sort of creators of disco, and the people that he worked with, like Gene Page, who most people don't know very much about, and very little has been written about. But these were people who, in some sense, and I would say this is true of Gamble and Huff at Philadelphia International Records, these are people who want to expand the palette of the sort of musical palette of what's available to African Americans. Why can't we create music that sounds more like Burt Bacharach? You know, why can't we? Why do we have to always sound like, you know, Otis Redding? It's, you know, it's not unlike, although it's very different from, but it's not unlike what Jimi Hendrix said. You know, I don't have to play soul music. I don't got to. And there he was referencing Otis Redding and, you know, and everybody else, yeah, but mostly yeah. Otis. And so there was a kind of, with disco, I would argue, for many performers and arrangers and producers, there was a kind of rebellion against the notion that black people and black music had to sound recognizably black. You could see this with Stevie Wonder complaining about why it is that he, you know, it's like, why can't I do country music? I love country music. So in some sense, I'm not saying that most of white America understood this. And I'm not sure to what extent every disco artist by any means was motivated by this, but I think some of them were, and you can find indeed interviews with Gamble and Huff in which they talk about, and they really are kind of proto-disco, and then they, you know, their music really does move sort of full tilt into disco, where they talk about their resentment of white rock critics telling them or telling the world that their music isn't really black. It's like, where do you get off?
Yeah, where do we get off? I mean, it all came, it's all black music. I mean, look, I mean, where would the Stones be without Robert Johnson and Muddy Waters and Chuck Berry?
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely true.
It's something crazy. So we're going to try to savage that in the edit. But Saturday Night Fever, in many ways, brought disco into the mainstream culture, and it kind of broke it in a way that allowed for its almost overexposure and eventual bastardization. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how, as you're a kid, and again, I'm just speaking from my own experience, mm-hmm. that if you're 7 years old, 7 and 8 years old in 77 and 78, and you have no real sense of a timeline yet, how Saturday Night Fever seemed to be the beginning of a movement. But in reality, mm-hmm. it's kind of like it really came along after the fact. Yeah. Where it was something yeah. that, you know, in its purest form had already passed.
Yeah, it's really, and you know, the executives who were working on that, I mean, the film company, they were like, the studio, they were like, they kept trying to speed up the release because they were convinced that disco was going to crash, that it was, you know.
Really?
That, you know, that they would, oh yeah, that they would miss it, you know. And so they were really eager to have that come out as early as possible. I mean, they were really racing, and at least according to what I've read. Yeah. And then, you know, Saturday Night Fever does change things. I mean, you're absolutely right. And I quote some people in the book who talk about how people, especially in more mainstream clubs, started to dance like, or trying to dance like the people in Fever. But it is just fascinating. I mean, I would love if, I mean, Saturday Night Fever, of course, it's based upon a completely, it's not based upon observation of those disco clubs. It was a story that was written by a British writer.
It's a New Yorker magazine,
took,
I think.
Yep. Who published this story in New York Magazine, and it got bought up by Stigwood, Robert Stigwood, and made into a movie. But he really, his source material was really his own experiences as a sort of observing mod culture in Britain quite a few years earlier.
So, go figure.
You know, yeah, I mean, so we didn't. So, I mean, it is true. So, I mean, Tony Manero and his friends, they're, you know, ethnic, you know, they're Italian Americans living in Brooklyn, and they're working class. And
you
so
think,
it
you
is,
think Saturday
you know,
Night
it
Fever
would have really
worked?
Interesting. And I think that there were, for sure, working class people who listened and danced to disco. We just don't have that history yet.
Do you think Saturday Night Fever would have worked if Tony were gay?
No.
Yeah, it was
because already, you know, if you look at some of the criticism that came out, it was clear that there were already ways in which the fact that he danced the way that he did, you know, there's that one curious scene where the camera sort of lingers on his body and on him in bed. And I think that there were people for whom, even though the Tony character is undeniably heterosexual, I think that there were people who found him, I mean, there were people who made fun of him as not fully heterosexual.
Right.
So, yeah, rock I don't fans. Think it would have worked at all. I mean,
people
think about
with a rock-centric mentality in 1978 were the ones that were saying that.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think it. I don't think it would have worked. I mean, think of how long it's taken. I mean, it really wasn't until the 90s that that began to really shift. Is that mostly because of the kind of bigger promotional machine now, or is it technological? Is there what's the shift about?
That takes so long for music to come out these days. You know what? If you ask me, I believe that trend started in the 80s when you had albums like Thriller come out. And rather than, you know, because it used to be album, tour, album, tour. I mean, the Beatles, if you go from the 60s through the 70s and even into the early 80s, where bands would release an album a year, some of them would release two or three albums a year.
Yeah,
in the case
yeah,
of the Beatles
yeah.
and Kiss. Okay, so when you had something like Thriller come out and you find that you can get 6, 7, 8 singles off an album, the labels started to milk the albums for as many singles as it can get. So, which is why you had that that trend exploding in the mid-80s, you know, Can't Slow Down, Lionel Richie, Born in the USA, Billy Joel, An Innocent Man. You know, each of them had 4, 5, 6, 7 singles off of it. And the run of an album, so where the run of an album would go from 3 months, 4 or 5 months at the most, before they were ready for new product, an album's run would be about 2 years. So artists were now taking 2, 3 years between albums because they had that luxury, because the label would milk it for all it could get and they would go off on these big 2-year tours. So rather than a tour being 2 months, it would be 2 years. And I think that was a trend that started in the 80s, and it's not so much of a trend now, because now you're seeing more artists releasing music more frequently. And I think a lot of them, because the ones that are still around are getting older and they want to work more. So you got people like Bruce Springsteen, who used to take, you know, 5 years between an album. Now he's releasing an album a year. Every 15 months, he's got something new out. So, I mean, that's
okay,
just my take on it.
Yeah. So isn't that fascinating?
It really is. I mean, it's kind of watching this whole thing. It's like America itself, you know. It started off as an experiment, and we don't know where it's going. You know, and it's really not that old. I mean, 200 something years. I don't know how old we are again. 204, whatever it is. It's really not a long time in the scope of history. It's really nothing in the scope of history. And in the case of rock and roll, you know, it comes along 54, 55. You know, rock and roll is here to stay. Rock and roll will never die. You know, it'll go down in history. They're already talking about it like it was a thing of the past. You know, and it wasn't. And the rock stars were not supposed to get old. You know, it was supposed to be something by the young, for the young. And so it's kind of interesting watching the Stones almost be the template for what is possible. Because they're the only ones that are really left that are still doing it. And it's kind of like they're the litmus test. And there's no precedence for this. This is it. This is, we're watching it
And we're still watching it as it's happening.
Not, it doesn't have the effect like it did with Van Halen or Jimmy Page or any of our guitar heroes.
So this is
like
five
that.
Old farts reminiscing about a time when the guitar was the center of our lives, man.
There
and,
are
and
no
rock
more
music
guitar
was
heroes.
The center.
You're my guitar hero, Eric.
Let me ask a quick question to you guitar player guys.
Oh, Christ.
Yeah, it's another food for thought question.
Agree on
man.
Something?
Maybe you might right now. Not. I'm listening to Live at Leeds the other night. Tell me, guitar players, why does Pete Townsend's name never come up when we talk about guitar players?
Because Pete Townsend is a great rhythm guitarist.
Is he underrated?
He was a great writer, too. He's a genius, I think. Genius.
Playing though.
He was a better rhythm guitar player
you
than
you don't
want to
ask me
guitar.
That question.
Absolutely.
The Who was about rhythm. It was about the bottom. It was about the bass, the drums, and Townsend just created his big fucking Jackson Pollock like mess on top of it.
Yeah. You know, and I am not. I am famously not a Who fan. You guys all know that. However, I'm going to definitely agree with what Mike just said because Entwistle and Moon were just ridiculous.
Yeah. Who was about the bass and the drums,
man. You could
play
a fucking Fisher Price guitar over that fucking bottom end. There's no doubt about it. I mean, that's just the foundation of a good rock and roll song is its rhythm.
But if anybody questions his ability, man, listen to Tommy, man. Listen to those chords, man. Listen to the chord progressions, man. Listen to the stuff that fucking progressions that were not existent, man.
What he wrote was incredible.
And I I've even said that as much as I dislike the band. Yeah,
he's not a great.
I would even say genius.
Yeah, he. But I mean, to me, Townsend is an artist before a guitarist, man.
You know, it's funny for.
But you know that I love and appreciate everything.
No, you know what?
If
again,
you're
it's
doing
all,
your thing and it makes you happy.
Absolutely.
Yes.
It's all perspective. It's all perspective. It's all what you like. I like.
It's your opinion.
Guitar players. I'm looking for, like, the best musician in the band. You know, like, the best musician is not always the guitar player. And even back then, Entwistle was a much better player than Pete Townsend at his instrument.
You're right.
John Bonham and Jimmy Page were not the best musician in Led Zeppelin. John Paul Jones was.
Interesting.
I agree there.
He played it all. Yeah. And he was and he could play it. He played mandolin. He played keyboards. He played bass.
And he was a good composer. Especially at the end.
Absolutely.
Especially at the tail end of Zeppelin. He held it together.
He was the glue to Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, he was the foundation.
In Through the Outdoor. That's basically him.
Yeah. It is. And they called in Robert Plant to sing on it.
Now, when I say musician, I mean just as a whole, not like Jimmy Page is an icon, a guitar player, but the best musician in that band, in my opinion.
What's bothering me more about Ticketmaster than anything is the lack of discussion about Ticketmaster in the media. And it's because Ticketmaster is, you know, the corporate media. Ticketmaster has their own table at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, okay? So this is why you're not going to see Rolling Stone magazine going after Ticketmaster. You're not going to see any of the corporate magazines and corporate publications going after Ticketmaster, talking about the corruption of Ticketmaster and how out of fucking control that they have become.
They are fucking disgusting. And the band that hammered them the most... I saw them that tour was Pearl Jam. The fucking ticket was like, you know, the size of my iPhone 7 Plus. It wasn't Ticketmaster. It was a Randall's Island show. That's the other fucking thing is that they got their hooks in to these fucking venues. It's all fucking money. Yeah. $600 for a fucking ticket or even a fucking place in line to get a ticket is just fucking absurd, ridiculous. They're a bunch of fucking thieves, all of them. Yeah. And I wish them nothing but the fucking worst. May your fucking hemorrhoids catch fire. Their computer generated.
And it's not just Ticketmaster that tries to prevent the bots.
No,
they're
all over the internet.
Websites.
I mean, Google uses them to their advantage. It goes out and searches the internet and finds different things, and that's how their search engine works. It's so fast. And those bots are out there constantly. Picture them like little fucking spiders, just fucking electronic spiders just out there looking, searching.
Now here's the part that's mind-blowing, man. The part that's mind-blowing to me is that they developed that CAPTCHA system where when you get on Ticketmaster and you're about to, like, choose your seats or whatever, after you're about to complete your transaction, they put you through this, you see this image of, like, fuzzy and distorted letters, and you have to copy it exactly how you see it.
Right.
And then you have to check that little box that says, I am checking this box to prove that I am not a bot. Right?
Right, yeah.
So I'm not a bot.
Right.
Okay. You check this fucking box off, and what they found their way around that. They study, they got a whole bunch of people like you and me to sit there and study these CAPTCHA images. And they found out that there's only so many of them. There's like maybe like 30,000 of them.
Oh, so you could write code.
It's not
to
an endless fucking
yeah.
thing.
Hackers
so they
right
were
on
taking
that.
Screenshots of those images, every image, and they put it into a JPEG file. From there, these bots studied.
Wow.
They learned the images.
Holy
and
shit.
And they found their way through that, and then they were enabled to get the tickets again.
Wow.
And then Ticketmaster later claimed that they were hacked. That the CAPTCHA system was hacked. It was not hacked. It was basically
beaten.
Like the computer found a way to
it
read it and respond to it like a human. So that's
fucking Terminator fucking 2 shit coming up here.
Yeah. This is in fact real life, folks.
Just getting that sound, experimenting, putting the microphones here, no putting them there.
Well, we did something that I swore I would never do again, which is I play guitar. The other guitar player in the band is Nick Doom, who owns a studio in San Francisco. That's pretty convenient, right? Your guitar player owns a recording studio. We're talking a real studio. This is analog, 2-inch tape, $1 million studio. Mm. Beautiful, beautiful facility. Nick Doom's a great guy. He's a fantastic guitar player. but the downside, double edge of this, is that you kind of have unlimited time to record. So we went way deep down the rabbit hole and just did every trick possible and put everything in the kitchen sink. So it's very much a studio record, like a Magical Mystery Tour is a studio record. You know, I love studio records. The early Dead records, you know, studio records just sounds just yeah. it was made to be a record.
We all agreed on that about the early Dead record.
Yep. But I'll never do it again because in the time it took us to do that, we could have made two.
How does it translate live when you record something like that? Are you having
a good
fun with it? Is it difficult? Are you the arrangement? Is the arrangement a fucking bitch?
It's fucking difficult because these songs are very difficult, and we, it's a different sound live. Mm. You're gonna have to come hear us.
We just borrowed some stuff from you, you know, getting into the people that cited you guys as influences. Right down to the song titles, man. I don't need to name the band names, but Live Wire, Fallen Angels, you know.
certainly the song titles, Monkey Business. Somebody else has a Monkey Business, and then there's every thorn, every rose has its thorn, which is basically a copy of Third Time's the Charm.
Third Time's the Charm, yeah.
There's no question. But you know what? That's okay. It wasn't plagiarism necessarily, you know, it wasn't.
No.
And
what did he say? Imitation
I mean,
to something.
If any plagiarism, it might be Cat Scratch Fever.
Mm-hmm.
That's exact. It's exact riffs that I do in Monkey Business, and we were playing with Ted, and he would sit right by the side of the stage, stand by the side of the stage and watch us, and then he went into the dressing room and he played Cliff Davies. I don't care if Ted hears this. He played Cliff Davies this new riff, and Cliff said, "Oh, I know where that came from." And
I know it's a cliche, man, but it is true. You guys, the music did sound ahead of its time, in the sense of, I could take like, "So Young, So Bad." Okay, the riff in that it's four mm-hmm. chords, four chords, okay, that became a very common chord progression in the 80s, and I can't mm-hmm. I can't sit here and name names because I can't think of any offhand, but it sounds so familiar, that chord progression, that you didn't really hear it before you played it, you know. And then it's kind of like, you know, well, you listen to, and then I'm not just keeping it, you know, it's not exclusive to hard rock and metal. Like I hear
song,
I hear fucking
there, like,
38 Special. You know, 38 Special took that song and made three songs out of it.
You like group Train? What was that great song? It's charted for like 200 weeks on the charts. Like
Drops
kind
of Jupiter
record.
Or something like that.
No, not that one. That's from the early 90s. It's the one from like 7 or 8 years, 5, 6, 7. It's about 7 years ago.
Yeah, I wouldn't know. That's the only one. It's the only
same
one.
Same chords. It's exact same chords.
Yeah.
But give Michael the credit for that. Michael wrote those chords. Of course, he didn't sound like that when he kind of had it sound like a folk song, but it was his chords. He wrote
Michael Lee
song.
Smith. We credit with So Young, So Bad from Coliseum Rock.
Well,
the
fourth
star.
That's understandable. It's understandable. If they can, they can.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the people, you still see the traveling, the sideshow of it, though, because they're selling things in the parking lot that are handcrafted or whatever they're doing to get money to even, if they go into the show, or they just hang out and they do their thing, and it's their lifestyle. That's what they do. From the guy selling fucking dollar whippet hits to the lady who's embroidering all kinds of really cool leather jewelry. I mean, they all have a place in that environment. It's really neat.
And you got to rough it a little bit, you know. If you're really into creature comforts, you're not going to go see the Grateful Dead, you know. We're all getting a little older. We like a nice soft pillow at the end of the night.
Nice little Hilton, the Hilton or something. You're not staying in a Hilton every night.
Scrub beneath our balls.
It's just sad to see. You should just enjoy the music, you know.
Fucking A.
Hey, Rob, it's Mark here. I don't know if they let you know that I was sitting here on this panel, too, but... just a couple things to what you were just saying, man. I'm also a fellow traveler. And, you know, first of all, who's got time to hate on anybody, right? Like, the Grateful Dead has always been about enjoying the moment, enjoying the music. So, like, who's got time for that nonsense to be hating about?
Exactly. Anybody,
right? But I just wanted to ask you, because this is my personal feeling. Still, my favorite incantation of the Dead since Jerry's passing was Further. That was my personal favorite band. I do like John. I do like John, and but he doesn't pop the music the way, in my opinion, it needs to be popped, right? And I always thought that Further was the best version, so to speak, of the Grateful Dead since, you know, Jerry's passing. How do you feel
about that? Listen, everybody has their opinion on whatever. Do I feel Further was great? Further was fantastic. You know, I didn't catch many, you know, shows. I've caught a few, you know. I was, at that time of my life, after Jerry, like I said, I seen him from 81 to 95. I actually wasn't in Chicago. I was living in Chicago at the time in Illinois, and I got to see Jerry's last show, you know, and all that, and whatever. I was, at that point in time, I had four kids, you know, and I stopped touring, and I stopped doing, you know, shows a lot. I was working and taking care of that, so I fell off for a while, you know, and then I got to see some Further shows, and I got to see, you know, other, you know, Rat Dog and Phil Lesh and friends I've seen, you know, and I've seen everything. Yeah, Further for sure was tight, was great, you know, and played well. This is just what it is now. Now that I'm free, my kids are older, and I'm going to be able to go and tour, yeah, I'm enjoying myself. As far as who's this, right? As far as Trey, like I said, I won't take nothing away from him. As far as comparing each one is different in itself. And yeah, we all wanted to keep going, like me, and I would love to have, you know, the original stuff that I seen growing up still on stage and going, but it's not possible. So I'm not going to judge other people. That's just me, you know. Yeah, I enjoy this, I enjoy that, you know. Even when Jerry was here, and even shows that I've seen, you know, they were bad shows. Jerry didn't have a great day filling this, you know. It was always that, man. It was horrible shows. I've only walked out of two in my whole life because it just bummed me out. But it is what it is. That's, it's crazy. Just music. I'm just there for music, so I don't judge. I don't put labels on that, you know. I don't go there, you know, because that's what everybody wants to do, and I'm just there to enjoy the music.
But I don't know. Did rock fans think that disco was going to threaten the existence of their music?
It did. I think it did for a while.
That's what that was. Sorry, man. Didn't mean to do it in your face.
Rockunderfire at gmail.com.
Hey, I got website news, actually.
But don't tell
Twitter
anybody.
Twitter and YouTube. And Facebook and iTunes. Please, I say this every time. Please, for the love of Christ, rate us and review us on iTunes. If you have an Apple account, you can do this. It's easy. Just go there where it says rate or review the podcast. We need this. It makes us look professional and important and stuff.
Yeah, but Mike, I don't have iTunes. I got
How do
Android.
I do it? How do I do it? Do I go into my phone and what do I hit? Do I use the keypad? Do
you
I need?
Love it best. Is it just gotta hit a different button?
Do I have to pay for it?
It's
is
free.
It free? I don't know. Is it? Am I going to be anonymous? Are they going to know my name?
Links, man.
Why the fuck am I here?
Lose, but I know how you love to win. Break my bed down and pick me like a giant.
bad news keeps pouring on me. Bad news keeps pouring on me. Bad news keeps pouring on me.